Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company. Now, last week I was up in Darwin for the annual Native Title Conference, and it's one of the biggest conferences in Aboriginal Australia. It brings together a whole host of people from across the country, not just working in Native Title or members of PBCs, for example. They also host a lot of people working in land rights organisations, in culture and heritage. So there always ends up being a wider discussion about the way forward for Aboriginal affairs. Now, this year, the keynote speaker was Professor Gerard Ty Alfred, who's from the University of Victoria and is quite well known even in Australia for his writings around Indigenous resurgence and decolonisation. Now, his keynote speech was quite amazing, I have to say, and all around the auditorium where it was given, there were just continual nods of agreement because it had so many similarities with where we find ourselves today. At the core of what he was talking about was the fact that whatever we get involved in land claims, in our case maybe Native Title, we also have to remember what it means to be Indigenous, and the core and the essence of being Indigenous is our tie to our land. And he spoke about his experience as a Mohawk man and his tribe and his nation and how they'd run into a lot of problems in relation to the state taking away a lot of their rights in relation to their land claims processes. And I feel that it resonated with a lot of people at that conference. And as I was talking to a lot of different people, they all said, oh yeah, you know, it was a really amazing speech. It had a lot of applications over here as well. So I was given the opportunity to sit down with Professor Ty Alfred and also his colleague, Jeff Korntassel, who I have also known of for quite a while because of his writings, particularly in the international sphere about Indigenous nationhood and decolonization in the international arena in relation to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I accessed a lot of his work previously. Over 5 or 6 years I've been reading it through one of his websites, www.korntassel.net. So I got to sit with both of them in Darwin and have a good chat. And I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed talking to them. So here's my interview with Ty Alfred, a Mohawk scholar, and Jeff Korntassel, who's from the Cherokee Nation and has a doctorate in political science at the University of Arizona. They're both currently at the University of Victoria. First of all, I just want to ask you, your mob and your country, so what's your ancestral land?
I'm Mohawk from the area south of Montreal. So what is now New York State and Ontario, the southern part of Ontario and New York State, that's my traditional territory. And I'm from a community called Gahnawake, which is right on the south shore of the St. Lawrence River across from Montreal. And it means by the rapids.
Beautiful. Can I ask you your mob and your country, Jeff?
Sure. So I'm from Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, and originally my family's from Tennessee and Georgia, and then removed forcibly in 1838, so ended up in Westville, Oklahoma, which is where kind of our ancestral territory is now.
Did you have to, I guess, regain some of that identity?
Yeah, I think, especially since I didn't grow up in my territory, so we actually, there's kind of a second wave of movement to California and places like that. And so I was born in Long Beach, California. And so, yeah, a lot of it's been to reclaim that kind of connection with relatives and also the language and things like that. So that's been it's a lifelong struggle. Yeah.
I guess coming into Australia, what do you see as the main differences coming into this country in relation to what we're talking about in relation to land rights?
In relation to land rights? I think the concept and the implementation of native title is much stronger here than it is in Canada, especially in the Northern Territory. We just came from a presentation on fisheries where they own 100%. Torres Strait own 100% of the resource, and they govern it, and they control it, and they benefit from it. That is unheard of in Canada. And the idea of Aboriginal title, as it's called in Canada, is predicated on the idea of the proof of presence, of a continuing usage, of no overlap, and so forth, which is basically impossible to do. So there's no acceptance of the notion of Aboriginal title in reality. It's a strictly theoretical concept, and so far only one single Native community in a very small portion of its own territory has managed to get recognition of Aboriginal title. And on top of that, it's a notion that allows for the abrogation of the title in the interests of the state, should it choose to assert its economic interests or the needs for settlement. So it basically means nothing. Whereas here, there's at least some teeth to it in certain areas. That's as far as I can see.
Did you want to add anything to that? Or?
No, I think, it's clear that there's a greater sense of autonomy here and also assertion of that autonomy regarding the sea and the ocean. As Dayagi mentioned, we just came from that fisheries panel. And then there's the similarities in terms of criminalization for undertaking, traditional livelihoods and activities on the land and the water that sustain you as a community. So I see those commonalities, but there's also even without so-called treaties being widespread in Australia, there's a much, greater impetus or willingness to assert that self-determining authority in over various issues.
Jeez, that's quite a surprise to me, and I think it would be a surprise to a lot of blackfellas, because I guess we see overseas as being better on Aboriginal rights because of the treaty issue, but obviously you're talking about your own tribe's negotiation with treaties, and it wasn't always sort of the shining beacon that we like to think of a treaty being.
It's not at all. I mean, the idea of treaty originates in North America in terms of people's conception of indigenous rights rooted in treaties, but the fact is, it's completely theoretical. There's very few instances where either Canada or the United States have actually honored a treaty. Even the modern-day treaties that were negotiated beginning in the 1970s in Canada, you would think, given the contemporary context with all the oversight and so forth, you would think that there would be instruments where, given that everyone knows and we're a participant in a contemporary environment with living memory, that it would be honored. But in fact, every single one of them, the people that have signed those treaties have had to go to court or exert political pressure in order to get the terms of those modern-day treaties implemented, and none of them have been implemented fully according to the original terms. So they're compromises to begin with. But even with the compromises, the government's not willing to do them once the public eye is turned away from them. And Canada's just very good at promoting a false image of itself on Aboriginal rights.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it definitely is, isn't it? When you talked about earlier this morning, could you tell me a little bit about the history of particularly the Mohawk Treaty and the historical treaty that was signed with your own people?
Mohawks we have 9 different communities, and every single one of those communities has a number of treaties in the kind of like historic period. Our community is the inheritor of the first treaty, the Gaswanta, the one that I mentioned, and that is more a treaty in terms of the spirit of the relationship, the founding agreement that allowed Canada and the United States to exist.
Yeah.
If the Haudenosaunee people and other people in that area hadn't engaged in that treaty-making process, it's not sure that these countries would exist. They certainly wouldn't exist in the form that they are right now, because it allowed for the development of a white presence in North America. If there had been resistance on the part of the Native people to the treaty, it would have been another 100 or 200 years before the development of that area actually happened. And it would have been the maybe 1800s before people were able to set up cities and so forth. I mean, as it was, the Dutch, the French, and later the English began to set up settlements, trading settlements, and then cities and towns and so forth, beginning in the 1600s and really into the 1700s. So the treaties are crucial.
Crucial for, I guess, white people, the people who are coming in.
Exactly. I mean, they were crucial, and they recognized that, and so they honored them. The problem is, as soon as they were able to, militarily and numerically, they ignored them. And they disrespected the treaties as soon as they were able. So they have, you know, the white society in North America has no integrity. It's just a false promise for instrumental purposes. As soon as they could get out of that false promise, they did. And so now they honor it as in rhetoric, as part of the heritage of the country. Oh, the treaties or the founding and blah, blah, blah. But in reality, you look at the terms of the treaty, they're not even honoring it in any meaningful way. And the Mohawk treaties are the same. We have the Gaswanta, and I think in my doctorate, I forget the number right now, but I think it's something like 116 treaties.
Wow.
116 treaties that my community is party to. Not a single one of them. No. So it's kind of an inside joke among our native people in North America, the idea of a treaty. You know, it's like it's an expression of our vision more than any kind of legal framework for actual relationship.
So I guess over here we've never had a treaty, and that's sort of always been the cry in Aboriginal Australia. Considering that historical use of treaty and modern use of treaty, how do you see it as our own calls for treaty over here?
A form of justice, I guess. I guess that seems the beacon of justice.
Yeah, I think it's, as Ty was mentioning, treaty is ultimately kind of a vision, a broader vision for reconciliation, if you will. But it's also a way we can envision living together on the same land. And so I could see that as a useful way to articulate that broader vision. And I think one of the things that's often missed in the treaty discourse is that folks look at the documents, but not necessarily the oral version of it, especially from the Indigenous side. And so those oral versions had a lot more depth and kind of understanding about even what peace and friendship entail. So I would say if that's the goal, you know, to keep it in the oral sense too and within communities. And I think for me, the more exciting things that are happening are inter-Indigenous treaties, so treaties between Indigenous nations, like the Blackfeet Nation, for example. They 10 Blackfeet nations basically signed a treaty on bison or buffalo in 2014. So that's a treaty that's to protect the buffalo, and it's irregardless of the state, irregardless of Canada or the U.S. So it transcends both of those borders. And then even Heltsik and Haida First Nations signed a treaty over herring and to protect the herring as part of a key to their sustainability. So I think as Indigenous peoples, we have to demonstrate to non-Native folks what treaty entails and how it's sacred and the spiritual aspects. And I think the best way to do it right now is between ourselves as Indigenous nations. We know it'll be upheld. We know it'll be consecrated with ceremony. And we know it'll be renewed in a way that's done right versus, as Ty mentioned, the standard treaty discourse, which is with the state, has been unfulfilled and, in a sense, empty. Yeah.
Why can governments get away with a lot of that rhetoric that you were talking about before?
Because our leaders allow them to. I think that the leaders are very practical and pragmatic in recognizing the fact that they're in a dependent situation, and they don't perceive themselves as being in a position of power to call to account governments. And that's unfortunate because it hasn't always been that way. You know, the reason we have treaty structures and all these kind of things is because our leaders thought differently in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s. They were quite willing to risk conflict, and they were quite willing to risk friction, and they sacrificed themselves, you know, in order to achieve some political objectives, whereas current generation of leaders on the whole are more pragmatic than that and think in terms of how to work within the parameters, the established parameters. And so the idea of risking either politically or personally anything is kind of foreign to the current generation of Native leaders in Canada, and that's why the Canadian government can get away from it. And that's aside from just the blatant co-optation and buying off of leaders, which happens, unfortunately. It's not the majority, but just like in Australia, just like in Africa, just like everywhere, they have their champions who they pay to promote their ideas. And I'm just totally disregarding those because that's a given. But the mainstream of the Native leadership has gone from being very contentious, very rooted in a nationhood perspective, to actually accepting the framework that the Canadian government has developed in exchange for peace and in exchange for the moderate level of financial support they get mainly for their organizations.
Yeah, the organization thing. Is that true from your experience as well? Or?
Yeah, I think, for Cherokee Nation, we signed, I think it was over 30 treaties with the U.S. And what's happening in the States now is more or less taking treaties and transforming them into compacts with states, which is a much less powerful document. It's almost like a business agreement that has an expiration date, usually 10 to 15 years. And so I'm finding kind of a dangerous trend of usurping our own treaty rights for something that's much less powerful and much less of a broader vision for hunting and fishing, for even other rights relating to land and water. And so the fear is always that it's going to be used politically to just renegotiate, often to the state's benefit.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm seeing. And I think a lot of the justification, it's kind of shifted us from, in some ways, being perceived as nations to more stakeholders. And that subtle shift is really dangerous because it takes away our sovereignty, our self-determining authority, and it makes us more or less just another stakeholder in the process versus First Peoples of the area. Yep.
That bleeds into a lot of what you were talking about in your keynote address around nation-to-nation relationships, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Can I ask you about the essence, what you're talking about, the essence of being an Indigenous person?
Yeah, I mean, what I talked about in my presentation and what I've come to realize over the last few years is that the relationship that we have with our country, as you say here, our homeland, is the thing that makes us Indigenous. You know, the relationship that we have with the plants, the animals, the spiritual power there, the rocks, we are Indigenous because we have those relationships and we honor those relationships through ceremony and through our cultural practices. So we respect those relationships, we honor those relationships, and then we take in and we give back. We take from and we give back, and it's that reciprocity and then the love that develops of the people to that land and vice versa that really defines us as who we are as a Mohawk. So Kanyagahaga is that's how we talk about ourselves. Ganyage is our land. We're people of that land. And, we can think about it in terms of legal definitions, identity politics, and so forth, and that's nothing but a distraction from what it truly is to be Indigenous. We see that in academia and in political circles where people are trying to define and argue about what it is to be Indigenous, all using white languages, white ideas, and a whole white framework. And then you get down to it, though, how many of them actually engage with the land in the way that we're talking about it here, and that all these people that are at this conference are talking about it. Very, very few political people and intellectuals do that. And that's a problem because we're beginning to kind of conceptualize indigeneity in a way that is completely foreign to an Indigenous worldview and culture. And so for me, that's why I use the word essence. It's a kind of a contentious, controversial way of thinking about it in academia. But in reality, you can go to any one of these communities, as you know, in any one of our home communities and talk to elders and people who actually live Indigenous cultures in their territory. And it's not contentious at all to talk about having to do that in order to be Indigenous. That's, in fact, the basic practice of being indigenous. And that's what I mean about the essence of it, is that relationship to the land. And it's something that I see not very present in most academic discourse around being indigenous. It's something that Jeff and I pointed to when we wrote the article in 2005 called Being Indigenous. We wanted to kind of focus on what the actual practices and the perspectives are to generate this dialogue and also a discussion for people moving forward about what do you need to do to actually be indigenous. You know, what kind of things do you need to do? And now it's taken us all the way from there to everyday acts of resurgence, to indigenous resurgence. And guess what? It's basically just taken us back to our ancestral wisdom and practice. And so that's, I think, the contribution that we're making, is to remind people about what it truly is to be indigenous and to think about the things they need to do in those terms and not get caught up in identity politics and all of this kind of stuff, which serves other people's interests and not the interests of our future generations.
So how does identity politics, I guess, play out in Canada and America? I don't know if it plays out the same way here.
Wow, you just opened up a whole new venue. It plays out in some really ugly ways, especially in the U.S. I'll talk more about the U.S. context, especially in the form of disenrollments, so kicking people off of the rolls. And oftentimes that becomes gendered. It's oftentimes women that are kicked off the rolls. It's oftentimes someone who's on the wrong side of a political dispute. And so it's the worst kind of, corruption of authority, in a sense that it's denying people their very identity based on a political purpose or political aim. And it's, you know, over the past 6 years or so, there have been about seen upwards of 3,500 to almost 4,000 people that have been kicked out of their communities for these various things. And so, on one level, old school Cherokee, being Indigenous, was living like a Cherokee, right?
Living your culture on your land.
Speaking your language, but it was kind of the convergence of all those things. And now you think about how complicated that might be, where, you know, over just about half of our community lives outside the territory, right? The language itself isn't spoken as readily. So what are the markers? What's the sense of that identity? And that's kind of the reason for writing that article, is talking about reminding people. A lot of resurgence is reminding people, remembering that, really, to be indigenous, to act on those indigenous principles, it has to come from the land and that relationship to that land. It can be in the city. It could be, you know, on reserve, off reserve. Those things don't matter as much as having that connection to land and acting on those remembrances, acting on those ancestral values.
I guess when we get caught up in that, or when people get caught up in that, is it doing the job of the colonizer for them? Because it's sort of assimilating a lot of people out of their... what it means to be indigenous, isn't it?
It is a danger, and that does happen. But I'll also add that it is the responsibility of indigenous communities to govern themselves. And so there's also the aspect of the necessity to govern. And part of that is creating mechanisms, fostering ideas that are consistent with your culture and the interests of your people about membership, meaning boundaries. Because the simple fact is, not everyone can be indigenous. And if you're going to claim to be a nation and to be a self-governing community, you have to deal with the issue of drawing a line somewhere. It's not like the 1950s, where no one wants to be native. Everyone wants to be native in Canada now. And so how do you govern that? So that's the other end of the spectrum, you know, between the kind of abuses that Jeff was rightly pointing to now the necessity to govern. And so we kind of, on the far end of the spectrum... Now we get the problem of where does the community and ancestral and nationhood authority mesh with the individual's right in a contemporary society to choose their partner, where they want to live, to assert an indigeneity?
That was Professor Jared Ty Alfred, a Mohawk scholar from the University of Victoria, and Jeff Corntassel, who's a Cherokee scholar from the University of Victoria, and they were in Australia, and I think they're still in Australia, actually, to give a keynote and a talk to the Native Title Conference up in Darwin. So I sat down with them while I was up in Darwin as well, and asking a lot of different questions about the differences in land rights in between Australia and Canada, but also this interesting I guess the universal experience of being Indigenous and what it means to be Indigenous and starting to reassert those rights in our own country. So we'll go to a break and we'll come back with my talk with Professor Ty Alfred and Jeff Corntassel.
Time with my family.
A bit of Warren H. Williams to get you through your Friday. I hope everyone has a great weekend planned. Now, back to my chat with Professor Gerard Ty Alfred and Jeff Corntassel, who Ty is a Mohawk scholar and Jeff is a Cherokee scholar. I really encourage everyone to go out there and try and check out their writings because they're really great reading. They're two scholars I was really excited to meet because I've been reading their work for quite a while, actually, particularly Jeff Corntassel's, and I'd interviewed him about 5 years ago. So it was really great to actually sit down over lunch in Darwin and meet him. And they were in Australia for the Native Title Conference, but after that, I think they went to Perth, and they're in Sydney, I think, this week before they head back. So I encourage all our listeners to go see them or even just check out a lot of their writings. Now, here's to the second half of the chat. I hope you guys enjoy. Do you want to add on to what Ty was saying about the issue around policing Aboriginal identity?
Sure. Yeah, I think for Indigenous nations, there's that self-determining authority, that ability to determine who our future citizens will be. And I think we have that right to determine that. It's in our best interest as nations in terms of our survival. And I think, as Ty was sort of alluding to, we also have the right to revisit that, and in a broader sense, to make our own mistakes. If I could speak really bluntly, yeah, we have the right to make our own mistakes and revisit how that might impact our nations because the stakes are so high, and so we don't always, you know, we make the best decisions at the time, but. There are times, for example, you know, Cherokee Nation has an anti-fraud division right now because fraud is so widespread. Is that the best way to approach this? And, you know, I mentioned living like a Cherokee was the more informal way of talking about identity. And now that's morphed into more of having a legitimate kind of identity card. And so what about the people that are descended from Cherokees but can't demonstrate it? Right, so we have to think about the messiness of this process, but we also have to make clear-cut decisions, especially when it affects the well-being, the health of our nation. And so, for that reason, you know, I always err on the side of there is a line. If you, just because you feel Cherokee in your heart, or you know, as other people have said, we're all Indigenous to the planet.
Yeah.
That is not compelling enough to me to say that you should be part of a particular Indigenous nation who has that relationship to place. Yeah.
When you talk about the relationship to place, I guess in Australia, a lot of governments try and talk about the right for economic development and to be able to use your land for economic development. Does that debate play out in Canada and America? I don't know who wants to answer that.
I mean, it's the big agenda now because of what I talked about earlier, where the leadership is kind of pragmatic. Rather than looking at land in terms of a balance between, you know, development for resources for financial independence and cultural usage to sustain our people spiritually and culturally, most of the leaders really look at land in the same way that the average Canadian looks at it, as a resource. And so the Canadian economy, just like in Australia, it's a raw resource extraction economy. And so mining, timber, uranium, that's the backbone of it, right? And so if people want to develop and have a vision of Indigenous nationhood, which is pretty much just let's close the gap in material standard of living between our people, it makes total sense to do that. It's not playing out that way, by the way, but like logically it makes sense to do that. But that is not what has been proven to be the necessary fix to the plague of colonialism, because our people, when they have money, they don't recover from colonization. It's when they have reattachment to land and culture that they recover or resist the effects of colonization. And so unless there's a real significant element in these visions which allow Native people to interact and gain spiritual and cultural sustenance from the land, they're actually helping to destroy our people, these agreements, more than help us, like, survive. So that's something that that's the message that we're putting out, but it's very, very much opposed to the current agenda in Canada.
How do we start to break through that, do you think?
I think for me, it's a lot of it's about revitalizing indigenous economies. And those indigenous economies, similar to what we were talking about today around fisheries, that's an indigenous economy centered around fisheries. It's an economy that serves the people versus an economy that's building into a neoliberal system and propping up a system that is ultimately just exploitative, that's trying to extract labor and resources from our land. And so I think we have to think differently about what's serving us as indigenous peoples and be in a position to make those decisions that are going to, in a sense, maybe enhance our traditional livelihoods. It might be hunting and fishing-based economy. It might be kind of a mixed economy where we can get into, you know, Cherokee Nation, we have casinos. So we have several casinos, and there's a lot of positive things that come from that. We have language immersion programs that come from that. We have a lot of, you know, cultural training that can come from that. But on the downside, it also has almost a gravitational pull on our people towards the allure of that larger economy. And it shifts us, it shifts our priorities into service industry, right? We're training a lot of people to be blackjack dealers and clean up after people in hotels, right? Is that going to serve the future of our nation? So we have to really think long and hard about how these current economic development projects are going to serve us way into the future, not just one generation from now, several generations. Yeah, so the immediate impact is not going to be clear. It's going to be long-term. How have we positioned ourselves, you know, vis-a-vis... So that's why I'm a big proponent of indigenous economies. Like, whatever that looks like for indigenous nations, it's on our own terms, and it's serving the people and the community. It's building the community versus making us all into little atomized, you know, self-interested individuals who are building up our resumes. Yeah.
Reminds me of a quote. One of the leaders yesterday said something like, we're in a 21st century capitalist system now. We just have to work with it, and that's all we have to do. Do you think that's an excuse, I guess, or a justification?
Well, I mean, my answer to that is, how's that working out for everybody else? I mean, are white people completely happy? Is the earth completely safe and sustainable? Is pollution not a problem? Is overconsumption not a problem? Is inequality not a problem? Of course, these are all major problems that white people are starting to recognize as inherent to the way capitalism has been conceptualized and implemented and has come to become the system. So to just say, oh, that's just the way it is, let's join up, is not even like a betrayal of indigenous worldviews. It's actually out of sync with the leading edge of thinking in white society as well. So I don't get that at all. I don't give it any credence.
You talked a bit about in your keynote speech as well in the 80s how there was sort of a militarized standoff, and you talked a little bit about the willingness to get up, actually fight. Do you think that could happen now? I mean, do you see the role of, I guess, violence as an answer, or what's currently happening in America? What's the sort of protest movements that are happening?
Well, that standoff, which was in 1990, happened in the context of a long-term assertion on the part of our people to have autonomy respected by the Canadian government. And it was kind of like the end point of a long struggle. And people had developed a kind of consistent ideology and a community around that, and a consensus that that's where it was headed. You know, granted, not all of us were part of the consensus, but it was a general consensus enough to make it happen where people supported it. Today, I talked to a lot of people at home, and we always talk about this kind of thing. It's like, could 1990 happen again? I don't know. I mean, there's some people that would want it to, and there's some people who are consistent with that approach. But for the most part, the economy in our community is built around business with non-Indigenous people. So the minute you have a standoff, there's no trade. It's a blockade. Nobody can come and buy stuff. So all of the major business interests and the elites within our society are dependent on a trade relationship. So right there, like in the microcosm, it speaks against it happening in Ganawagi. But overall, it's even less of a possibility because I think Canadian Indigenous leaders have been so ingrained with the idea that they are Canadian that their horizon only goes so far as Canadian law. And if Canadian law says pushing back with militarized force or even just direct action in terms of physical confrontation, if that's illegal, they won't do it. Besides that, most of them are lawyers. So if you advocate breaking the law as a lawyer, you will get disbarred. And so the fact that we're led by lawyers is an unspoken problem because no lawyer is going to advocate that. And when our leaders were chiefs and clan mothers and political activists and so forth, it was less of an issue.
Do you see, can I get you to explain why you don't see yourself as Canadian?
Because we're not. Canadians in our language means the people who came, you know, we jokingly refer to it, Ganajaw, as people who are like squatters. Because you could put it together and say Ganada is a town and Sajan is sit. So if you put those two words together, it means someone sitting in our town. So like a squatter. It's we're conscious of our history. You know, our people are very educated as to our own political history, as to the history of the land and the interactions. And anyone who knows their own history knows that they're not Canadian, because Canadians are people who came from Europe. And how am I from Europe? Yeah, everybody's got mixed blood these days. But as far as our political community and our heritage goes, the majority of it and the 100% consistency with our community is of a community that was here and a nation of people that has been here for thousands of years. So the question needs to get reversed. Like for a Mohawk, it would be like, how can you think of yourself as a Canadian? That's just ridiculous. You know, Canada only existed for 200 years. Yet we've been here for thousands. At what point did we like give up on being Mohawk and become European? It's a bizarre question for a Mohawk.
Like conceding a bit of your sovereignty if you were to say you were Canadian?
It's surrendering all of it because that would say they won. You know, they're right that this new thing they've built with its rhetorical commitment to multiculturalism and Aboriginal rights but rock solid establishment on white power is your new political identity. And you need to accept that. If you say you're Canadian willingly, then yeah, they've won. And so that's very much a Mohawk perspective on things. And we just have a consistency on that. Granted, you know, people need to live their lives and people have Canadian passports. There are Mohawks that have Canadian passports and people get driver's licenses and all that kind of stuff. But it's a very rare Mohawk who, if you ask the question to and say, are you Canadian, they'll say yeah. It's not something that we're willing to surrender.
Yeah. The same with Cherokees?
It's not. It's not. I think I'd probably be in a really slim minority to say that I'm Cherokee first and foremost. and that, you know, the colonial power that granted me U.S. citizenship, we didn't ask for it. And so, you know, we'll take advantage of those, you know, those citizenry ties to our benefit. But I don't really, to me, that's just incidental to being Cherokee. And so I think a lot of Cherokees would view themselves as probably dual citizens or as kind of Americans who happen to be Cherokee. So it's been a real displacement of values over the years. Just, you know, the sheer force of 500 years of, you know, colonial imposition and encroachment has changed our values in some ways. And so I think folks, again, that's why we stress so much the act of remembering. You know, remember Dragging Canoe, who fought against the U.S. and created a Chickamauga Confederacy that lasted over 20 years, right? That was over treaty rights. And it was also about challenging the taking of more Cherokee land. So remember these people that have stood up for Cherokee nationhood. And it wasn't so that the U.S. could displace us or that we could fit within the U.S. value system. It was so we could be Cherokee. And so the question I always ask is to challenge myself and other people is, how will your ancestors recognize you as Cherokee? What will that look like, right? How are you recognizable? And if you're saying you're a U.S. citizen, how is that recognizable as a Cherokee, right, to your ancestors or even to future generations?
So what does Indigenous resurgence mean to you?
Well, it's the commitment to and the enactment of our ancestral philosophies and responsibilities. It's basically what it is. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of strategies and practical realities in negotiating a relationship with the state. So I can be critical of land claims as I am and all this stuff, but the primary task I think that we face right now is the preservation of the fire of our existence, our ancestral ways and our connections and our sense of ourselves. That's what resurgence refers to. So it's not so much a paradigm or a concept oriented towards the relationship outside. It's more about what do we need to do inside to maintain our existence, and then have the young people ingrained with the belief that it's their right and responsibility to carry that out. And the interface, whether it's positive or negative with the state, is a secondary concern. So we'll go and do the things we need to do according to our ancestral teachings and our spiritual teachings. And if the state chooses to validate them and make space for that, great. If they choose to oppose it and suppress it, then we'll be fighting. So, but it's not a political project founded on the fight or the contention. It's challenging the state to do the right thing and recognize the necessity of us doing these things. And we get into the struggle against the state only when it chooses to block that or disrupt it or prevent it from happening.
Do you want to add something to that?
Sure. It's hard to add to that, but I'd say it's kind of the regeneration of our peoplehood, and whatever that means to people, but it's acting on and in a sense honoring those values and those relationships that make us healthy and promote our community health and well-being. So it's focused on the community versus on the state or on other entities. It's focused on the community in the sense of how can we enhance our health and well-being and promote those acts of remembrance, but also promote those acts of relationship and renewing relationships. So it's about, I guess it's about our future as Indigenous peoples versus something that's conditioned on decolonizing the state. Yeah. That's a reframing or turning away from the state and focusing solely on ourselves. Yeah.
Was Jeff Korntassel ending that chat there, and I spoke to him, who's a Cherokee scholar, And Mohawk scholar Gerard Ty Alfred, who were in Australia for the National Native Title Conference. Both really impressive people, and I encourage everyone to get out there and sort of read their writings, because I know I've been reading it for quite a while and I think it has a lot of applications over here. I was particularly interested in what Ty was talking about, treaties and their experience in treaties, particularly amongst the Mohawk Nation. And I think as we enter this sort of debate around whether we want a treaty or what form it should take, we should look overseas, I guess, and see how colonial settler states have dealt with other Indigenous peoples in relation to a treaty, because we've never had one, obviously. And I also sat down with, and I hope to continue sort of this conversation over the next couple of weeks, I sat through a forum they also had around constitutional reform, and it had a presence from the Recognised Mob in the form of Rachel Perkins, who's a strong promoter of Recognise, but also had people like Indigenous rights professor and constitutional law expert Megan Davis at UNSW, Shireen Morris from up Cape York Partnerships, which is Noel Pearson's sort of think tank, and also Marcia Langdon, who is obviously the University of Melbourne professor. So it was quite interesting. They gave a talk about constitutional reform, but about these conventions that are going to be happening in the near future around the country. And there's actually going to be three meetings leading up to those conventions to decide what the conventions will talk about. And they're going to be split. I think there's going to be one in Thursday Island, in Broome, and up in, and down in Melbourne. So I hope to bring you a lot more information about that. But I think it's interesting because constitutional reform and treaty are being sort of put together as sort of this binary, this or that. And really, I think they do completely different things. I think constitutional reform obviously seems a bit inferior to the idea of treaty. Treaty is, I guess, being framed as the strongest form of recognition here, because it's about sort of dealing with the unfinished business of the past that we, that Australia just refuses to do it. And unfortunately, it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that have to bring them dragging and kicking, creaking and screaming to the actual debate. But if we look at treaty, we also have to decide what form it has to take, and we have to try and obviously do it in a way that takes in a lot of the opposing arguments, I guess, and look overseas for that historical perspective. I think that's really important for us peoples to do our research and decide what we really want, because this might actually be a really a turning point, I guess. It's this opportunity, and there's this groundswell movement now reinvigorated around the idea of a treaty. So I was particularly interested in what Ty Alfred was saying around that, and also around identity politics. We have our own form of identity politics over here consistently playing out, and it's very different than over in Canada and America, obviously, but still quite toxic, isn't it? And I think it comes from the fact we, even though we still have our sovereignty, we never ceded our sovereignty, obviously we don't have that same, that nation-to-nation relationship with the Australian state. In fact, we're very far behind in relation to that. It's a long weekend, so I won't be talking to you again until I think Tuesday, but obviously have a great weekend. Stay safe. We'll be back next week. I particularly am excited next week about a chat I'm having around the historical views and colonial perceptions of Aboriginal women, and that'll be playing next week, and I really hope you guys can join me for that. For now, I'll leave you with another song, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Next week. You guys have a great week.